Some biotech firms are on edge after an uptick in international corporate espionage cases. Reporter Brian Thompson met with one company whose high-tech seeds were stolen. It's a rice engineered to grow human proteins for research.
I wanted to go to a field where the rice is grown, and they wouldn't even think of it. And I even offered to be blindfolded, and they still wouldn't do it.
We'll take a look at what corporate espionage looks like in the Midwest. Plus, parts of Illinois were hit hard by flooding last month.
The water was just coming in so fast that the water got up and knocked out the power panel to the pumps. And then the bowl that we're in just kept filling up. There was nowhere for the water to go.
We talked to Principal Phil Georgia of W.J. Murphy Elementary School in Lake County. I learned about a new report that shows which school districts in Illinois are at greatest risk. But first, the latest on negotiations to fund public schools in Illinois. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in again for Nyla Boodoo. Yeah, anyone following state politics knows that Illinois jumped from a state budget crisis right into a school funding standoff. Districts expected to see money flowing for the coming year by this week. That's not likely to happen. While negotiations continue, we may get more details today on the full effect of Rauner's changes to the school funding bill. Plus, the comptroller calls out the governor for not doing more to help pay down the state's debts. And there's now a Barack Obama day in Illinois. It's Monday, the day when we talk state politics. Today, Chicago Tribune State House reporter, Bureau reporter Monique Garcia on the line from Springfield, and Chris Kergard, political reporter with the Peoria Journal-Star. Both of you, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning. So, Monique, I mean, let's start with you. You know, August 10th is the date schools expected to start getting state money. It's August 7th now. Any chance that happens, and how bad is it for schools if it doesn't?
Well, I think that unless something drastically changes in the next couple days, it is likely that schools will miss that first payment. And we've been told that without that payment, it's unlikely that any school won't open, but that causes some real pain in terms of whether or not schools will be able to offer a full contingency of programs, whether or not they're going to have to borrow to try to make ends meet, and also, you know, how long they can go without money. It's important to note that not only are they not getting this first school aid payment, a lot of schools, because of the budget fight, have been waiting for about $1 billion in funding for other programs that they already offer.
So they're already behind
the ball.
It's kind of
a double whammy here.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And then you've got, Chris, I mean, Governor Rauner said the other day that once the Illinois State Board of Education, they do an analysis of this type of bill and kind of say, yeah, they kind of try to predict the overall effect. And you know, he says that once that comes out, people are going to support this. He says, you know, that ISBE review, as I mentioned, the intro could come as soon as today. But there was a glimpse on Friday of how that might play out. The Civic Federation released some numbers in Chicago. What did we learn there?
Well, there's a great deal of unknowns that are still out there about this. And as people have dived a little bit more into the rewrite, there are other indications in there of some things that people had not really thought about and are having to do recalculations on the fly. We found out in Peoria, for instance, looking at some of the language in there regarding TIF districts and statewide numbers on helping hold school districts not entirely harmless, but restoring some of the money that they lose from not getting money out of areas that have been put into TIF districts, that would go away. In Peoria, that could mean losses to the tune of $1 million just from those reimbursements in the program. And
Chris, just real quick, I mean, TIF districts, so that's areas of cities, and Chicago has a number of them, but like you said, also Peoria, where, you know, some of the funding that normally go into property taxes to pay for schools can be used for economic development and things like that.
Exactly. The increase in value in the property, the increment as it goes up in those districts, and some of them are just a few blocks of area. Others of them are whole districts of a city that are included in it. As that value increases, that's held in reserve for economic development, for property improvements in those areas, and does not go to other taxing bodies. School districts have complained for years about this as an issue. They say they're being disadvantaged by it, and coded into existing state funding for education is a partial reimbursement of some of that. So effectively, taxpayers are subsidizing the loss to those districts. And the governor's proposal, which as near as I could tell had not originally been a part of the original negotiations, the governor's rewrite, his mandatory veto, does include language removing that, which is new and different to a lot of people, and it seems to be adding a whole new dimension of debate to the topic here as you get into trying to change behaviors of municipalities in education legislation.
Well, and we should talk a bit about the negotiations here in a minute. Manny, coming back to you here, you know, now that we've seen some of the changes that the governor made, because for a long time we just didn't know. He wouldn't say what he would do in terms of these changes to SB1, but it is fairly broad. I mean, can you remind us some of the bigger picture things? You mentioned TIF districts there. What other things were changed in that bill?
Sure. So he also stripped out some money, a special block grant for Chicago Public Schools to the tune of about $250 million. He wants to shift a pension pickup payment for Chicago and move it to a different bill, which is a whole other political and legislative battle there. There's also some changes in terms of just the hold harmless. So for years surrounding this argument, there's been calls from districts that, hey, if we're going to change this formula, which a lot of people view as inadequate and unfair, no school district should lose money. He removes that. And so down the road in a couple of years, it's very possible that a whole lot of districts can lose money, particularly those who've seen enrollment drops over the last couple of years.
That was a big part of what a lot of people wanted to have included in there. Did he say why he removed that part of it?
You know, a lot of this was an argument about, you know, this is about Chicago Public Schools unfairly getting money. And he says most people focus on CPS having a losing enrollment, but that, you know, other districts really need to be able to have some of this money that we would set aside unfairly for CPS. So his argument ahead of this AV was that we'll take that money and we'll put it aside and we can distribute it to other school districts. But, you know, as Chris noted, a lot of his changes went way beyond what folks had expected, and so they're going to have to rerun these numbers to really show what districts hurt. And Democrats say at the end of that, it's likely to be a lot of downstate districts represented by Republicans who stood by the governor and supported this AV without actually knowing some of the details of his changes.
So you've got the CPS grant, that block grant for students, you've got the pension cost, the TIF districts that Chris is talking about, the hold harmless. I mean, some significant changes. Are there any chances, Monique, that these changes get approved, get overridden, that there's some action on this bill now in the General Assembly, or is that done?
That's the big question here. So the Illinois Senate has until the middle of next week to decide what they're going to do. If they don't take up the governor's changes at all, the bill essentially dies and the whole process would have to start over again, and there'd be that big question mark about whether or not schools would get any funding at all this year. Mm-hmm. So the likelihood of an override is a little easier in the Senate where there's a larger Democrat majority, but it's a real, real big question in the House. And so, you know, Democrats said they were hoping to avoid going down this combative path. They wanted to have some kind of negotiations, and there did seem to be some movement towards that before the governor's AV came out. But these changes have really kind of poisoned the well in the Capitol, where there's already a whole lot of bad feelings on both sides. So it's unclear if lawmakers are going to be able to stand together here. They would need Republican support. They would need Republicans to, like they did on the budget override, buck the governor, and it's unclear if folks are willing to do that again.
Well, and even the tone around the negotiations, you're kind of getting it there, you know. So without a straight-up vote here, it is up to negotiators to work out some sort of a compromise. Illinois Public Radio education reporter Dusty Rhodes talked with Republican State Senator Jason Berrickman. The governor had assigned him to work in part on some of this compromise, and here's what he had to say.
Some perceptions are that everyone's working in some room together off the same script, when in reality, he's the governor. He's the head of the executive branch. I'm a Republican member of the legislature.
Monique, I mean, what you can kind of hear the different parties involved here and sort of who's in charge and who's making the call on what and who's proposing what ideas. What does this tell us about kind of the state of negotiations right now?
Well, I think it shows that lawmakers might be talking amongst themselves and think they get close to the deal, but the governor ultimately decides whether or not he's going to support something or not. And this is similar to complaints that we heard from both sides over budget negotiations, where it seemed that perhaps everybody was swimming in the same direction towards the same goal line. Then at the end, the governor decided for whatever reason that he wasn't on board and kind of pulled the rug out from under folks. So there are a lot of questions among Republican lawmakers about how far they can go out in terms of of being independent negotiators before they kind of get pulled back by the governor here. So there are a lot of competing folks here, and it's important to remember that the governor has some new staff, and they're from the Conservative Illinois Policy Institute. They've been on record as being opposed to this so-called evidence-based funding formula for a long time now. They believe in school choice, which is giving more money to private schools and allowing people to pick charter schools. So there's some folks who believe that this is a conspiracy to tank the whole thing.
Well, and Chris, I mean, that gets to something you were talking about before in terms of these negotiations. They're ongoing. You know, we don't know where they might go, what might be put in, what might be taken out, what other changes we might see. We're hearing little bits and pieces. Last week, WBEZ in Chicago got a copy of one proposal. Education advocates said that they had met with the governor before he had issued the mandatory veto, but proposed a $100 million scholarship program. Some are calling it school vouchers, others call it a tax credit. You know, but we've been talking a lot here about, you know, SB1, Money for Chicago, evidence-based funding model. But, you know, what are the chances we wind up with something very different through all these negotiations?
Yeah, I think it's possible that you end up with the, at least the attempt to include some very, very different things in it. And certainly an idea like that, whether you call it tax credits or school vouchers, and let's be clear on what this would be eligible for. It would be eligible. Illinois families, more than two-thirds of Illinois families would be eligible under the program that WBEZ reported on that's being discussed. Families earning significant amounts up to $113,000 a year would be eligible to receive some form of credit that could be used in it. And I would imagine that something like that would be very popular, particularly among Republicans. One of the challenges in legislating so far, whether it be on education, whether it be on the budget, whether it be on a number of other things that the governor's staff has faced, is that they have these things that they want, but they've struggled with coming up with something that can be palatable to a majority. In this case, Democrats almost universally have concerns, given their support from teachers' unions and other organizations, have their concerns about anything that would be perceived as opening the door much more widely for vouchers or other things like that. So the ability to craft a majority around something like that is going to be a challenge for the governor and his staff.
Yeah, and it's quite, I mean, right now, especially with some of the tone and the partisanship that we're seeing. Monique, I mean, switching gears here from the, well, let me ask one quick question first. Monique, as we look ahead now, you're sort of coming up on this August 10th deadline. You've mentioned there's another deadline for lawmakers to take action or not on this. Are there some, what should we be watching for right now in the next couple of days or weeks?
Well, the key point will be when the Senate decides to call members back. It's not always easy to get everybody back in Springfield over the summer. It's a bit akin to herding cats at times. So we've heard that there's a possibility that could happen this Sunday, over the weekend, perhaps early next week. And so that will be really kind of the next key date to watch.
Okay. Well, let's switch gears. I mean, there's a lot of other things going on right now. Just today, the comptroller, Susana Mendoza, you know, called out the governor for to step in, help pay down some of the state's debt that was piled up over this the long-running budget standoff there. What's she asking the governor to do right now?
She is asking the governor to move forward on a plan to allow the state to borrow up to $6 billion in bonds to pay down this backlog. So while we didn't have a budget in place, that did not mean that the state did not spend money. So throughout that course, we continued to actually spend more money than we had coming in because the tax rate was lower. And so I think the backlog at one point was over $15 billion. And the longer that backlog goes and the longer it takes the comptroller to pay people, the more interest the state racks up. So the state's paying hundreds of millions of dollars in interest on these bills that it can't pay on time. So the argument is akin to refinancing. Let's borrow some money from Wall Street at a lower rate, get some of those bills paid, make some of these providers whole, push down our backlog, and pay down Wall Street over a slower period of time but at a cheaper rate.
And the governor needs to take action in order to issue those bonds and make that get that money rolling.
Correct. So the governor's office has to basically allow this bonding authority to move forward. The comptroller says that she's issued two or three letters and has made several phone calls in an attempt to ask the governor to get this process moving, and he hasn't responded or hasn't responded favorably. So we actually talked to the governor's office this morning briefly, and they said, you know, there are several other questions that we want to have answered before we move forward. That includes in the budget, the comptroller is allowed to do some fund sweeps, borrow from some other funds to help lower that overall debt. And the governor's office says we want to see what she does first to try to lower that bill backlog so we can see how much we actually need to borrow if we're going to go forward. But if is the big question here.
And in the meantime, at least a press release from the comptroller's office this morning said $2 million extra a day in interest payments. While this is being figured out. Chris, just real quick, we've only got about 30 seconds left, but not a holiday in Illinois, but Illinois now has a Barack Obama Day. When is that, and what's it supposed to signify?
It is August 4th, effective next year, because the governor waited on signing that until he did, and it didn't get sent to him until later. But it'll simply be an acknowledgement of Barack Obama and his legacy. No state workers getting any days off for it. No holiday for school kids because it's in the middle of the summer. Just an acknowledgement of the president and his legacy. And that's one of several pieces of legislation that lawmakers passed to honor him over the past year.
All right. And of course, the state fair opens on Friday. The governor will be there. A lot of other events coming up in Springfield there over the course of the next week. That's Chris Kjærgaard, political reporter, Peoria Journal Star. I'm Monique Garcia, Chicago Tribune State House Bureau reporter, on the line from Springfield. Thank you both. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up, we'll talk a lot more about SB1 and the governor's veto and what's going on with school districts right now. Join us tomorrow at 11 o'clock, talking with the superintendent of one downstate district who says he's glad that the governor vetoed Senate Bill 1. Also get a little bit of a fact check on what's really going on, the idea of what is a bailout for Chicago Public Schools, what is not. Our reporter Matt Dietrich joins with a fact check on that one. So be sure to join us tomorrow on the 21st as well.
Support for the 21st comes from the School of Social Work at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing tomorrow's leaders to be advocates for and agents of social change. More information at socialwork.illinois.edu.
Thanks for listening to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. When it comes to natural disasters in the United States, flooding is the most common, as we saw in parts of Illinois recently. It's also the most costly. A new report from the Pew Charitable Trust highlights the importance and the risk of flooding through the lens of public schools. They put together a list of which areas, which school districts are at greatest risk across the country. One of the highest risk counties in the country is in southern Illinois. We'll learn more about that in a few minutes and talk with our principal there. But first, we go to northern Illinois, up to Lake County, which was hit recently with some major flooding in the last month. I'm joined now on the line again by Phil Georgia, principal at W.J. Murphy Elementary School in Round Lake Park. Phil, welcome back to the 21st. I appreciate your time.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
You know, it's been, what, a couple of weeks now since we last spoke, the damage at your school because of the flooding there. At that time, you were cleaning up. How do things look right now?
We're looking pretty good. It's amazing how quickly the cleanup work went. It took a couple days for the water to get pumped away from the building, and then a restoration company came in and gutted the whole building. I think, you know, there's pretty much nothing that was salvageable, so the whole lower level was cleaned out. And then they're in the process now of drying the building out. We're running a lot of air quality tests to make sure we're ready for the first day of school. And we're bringing in some portable classrooms. So our goal is to have portable classrooms delivered next week, have the upper part of the building ready to go, mm-hmm. and be able to conduct school.
Nice. So moving along there, and more fortunate in some cases than some of the other buildings, obviously, in the area up there. But, you know, this Pew report is taking a look sort of more broadly at areas and the impact on areas even beyond the schools in terms of what flooding can do in a community. Does your area there have a history of flooding around the school?
So we've had, some various floods. The village has, our school's kind of built in a little bowl. We're a little different than some of the other nearby areas that flood because of rivers overflowing.
Right.
And so there's a retention pond just about a quarter mile from the school, and there's pumps in there that whenever we get excess water, pump it out. The issue we had this time was the water was just coming in so fast that the water got up and knocked out the power panel to the pumps. And then the bowl that we're in just kept filling up. There was nowhere for the water to go.
Yeah, some of the sort of that low-lying areas. We'll talk.
So some of that's happened before, but the it's normally something that the retention pond and the pumps can handle. We'll see it fill up, but never to a point where it's damaging so many homes.
Yeah, and so when it does happen like this, I mean, what are some of the ways that flooding affects the community? I mean, is your school building used for other purposes? Are there meetings and community groups that come in there? Is it a place to go for storm shelters in some instances? Beyond just the day-to-day school.
Yeah, it's used to a lot of community groups come in. The soccer field, the big field we have right behind our school, is used by numerous groups for soccer throughout the year. During the year, obviously, the building is used a lot for after-school organizations. There's a community garden that's also back there, and the flood got up to and covered about a quarter of the community garden, so that's something that a number of people have been affected by. And then, our school is a neighborhood school, so there's neighborhoods and houses all around, and the playgrounds are busy all summer with kids. And those have been out of commission for a while now.
Yeah, so even during the summer, I mean, you can see this how widespread the community and the involvement is in that area. Do you think, I mean, in terms of preparation, one of the things, and we'll talk with somebody from Pew here in just a moment about the specific and the data and how they mapped it and all that with the report, but one of the things they talk about is just preparation and planning and things like that. Based on what happened there recently, does it change anything going forward? Do you see any planning or any tweaks that need to happen to make sure that something like this can be avoided or responded to as quickly as possible if it happens in the future?
Yeah, so the the village of Round Lake Park that we're in has done a fantastic job of handling the situation, and I know they've got after this major flood they had some plans to move the power panel for those pumps higher up.
Okay.
So that even if the water really starts coming in faster, it's not going to get to a point where it knocks the power out.
And that would keep you dry.
Yes.
As long as the pumps were still going. Well, Phil George, I appreciate it. Like I said, we want to get to that Pew report and dig a little bit more into the data, but Phil George, principal of Murphy Elementary School in Round Lake Park, thank you. It's glad to hear that you're cleaning up quickly and school should open here on time.
Great. Thanks so much.
Let's go now to that Pew study. And Laura Lightbody directs the Pew Charitable Trust project aimed at reducing the impact of weather-related catastrophes on U.S. economy, communities, and the environment. As I mentioned, they've put out this new report about flooding as it relates to school. And there's an interactive map. You can search, find your community's risk. We'll tweet out a link to that if you follow us at 21st Show. I have it also available on our website. But Laura Lightbody, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So we heard, Principal Georgia there kind of describe, we'll go to southern Illinois, to Tams, the area around Cairo, along the Mississippi in just a few minutes here. But, we heard there from the principal that flooding can have, real consequences for the schools, for the surrounding communities. Why this issue? Why is it so important right now for you guys to be looking at?
Yeah, flooding is one of the most common and costly natural disasters in the United States, and we really wanted to understand how vulnerable communities are to flooding. And we often think of damage to homes or roads and bridges, but we don't often think of communities and their schools. There are over 96,000 public schools across the United States that are occupied by 50 million students. So when a school is impacted by flooding, as we heard, it can mean more than a day off of school. It can impact families, disrupt childcare, transportation. Sometimes that school serves as the community center. When there's an emergency, that can go out. So this research tried to understand the vulnerability that schools face when it does flood.
And it ties in the dangers in terms of flash floods that can happen very quickly, which is a safety issue, as well as what happened up in northern Illinois here in Lake County, which was the water came in and affected the building and things, while folks weren't there. But just looking at your data, I mean, what are some of the takeaways for you as you compiled this list?
The main takeaway for us is that all 50 state schools are vulnerable to flood risk. It's not just limited to the coast. Inland counties are impacted as well, and Illinois knows that all too well.
Mm-hmm.
We looked at the 100 counties with the highest composite flood risk scores, And in those counties, there are more than 6,000 schools and over 4 million children who attend those schools. That's roughly 10% of all public school students across the nation.
So if I'm a parent, if I'm a principal, if I'm in one of these areas and look on that map and I see that I've got, you know, one of the ones that are higher risk, what do you want folks there to know?
You know, flooding is a shared responsibility between families and individuals, schools and communities, states, and the federal government. We hope that this research provides an indication of that flood risk and that schools will really be proactive, parents will be proactive about flooding with an eye towards the future to protect these generations from future flood risk.
Are there specific recommendations? I mean, in terms of those, you know, what you want some of those people to do, are there policy suggestions or sort of best practices that are out there in some form?
Sure. One of the things that the research points to is that there is a real data gap. So there are about 12,000 public schools across the United States that are in areas that don't have flood maps. Those flood maps are an indicator of where cities should plan and develop. They're an indicator of risk. They provide a measurement for insurers. And so we really need to support the mapping program, make sure that Congress and the federal government is providing adequate funding. And secondly, make investments in preparedness. We know that every dollar invested in mitigation, those preparedness activities, saves us $4 in recovery costs. So let's make those smart investments now before disasters strike to protect our kids.
Yeah, so they're getting back to that planning that the principal was talking about a few minutes ago. Speaking of principals, let's go now to Southern Illinois. Brett Gowan, principal of Egyptian School District in Tams, Illinois, located in the southernmost part of the state, so that far down tip where the Mississippi comes winding around the bottom of the state down there in Alexander County. Brett, welcome to the 21st. I appreciate you joining us.
You're welcome.
So, you know, Tams, not far from the Mississippi River, you know, as I said, down sort of in the Cairo area, a lot of levee systems and things like that down there. But the area is listed in the Pew data as one of the most at risk for flooding. Can you describe what does your district look like in terms of, you know, water and geography and where the schools are located?
Well, our district encompasses the north part of Alexander County, everything north of Cairo. It's a rural community. We have levees all along our western border, and the Ohio River also affects our district when it raises.
Okay, so you've got sort of multiple regions there, multiple bodies of water coming through. Now, you know, I understand that the school sort of where you're at is a little bit removed, but that there is a nearby community where there is a levee, and that while the school in some cases has remained dry, the community has really been affected by water. Can you describe sort of that levee in Miller City and what you've seen there in recent years?
Well, the levee it was built by farmers, and in the last flood, the waters breached the top of the levee and caused it to start to erode. And since then, we haven't had any chance to have that repaired. It's pretty severe in the effects it could have on our community and the river trade as well.
And that's not, so that's, it was, you said it was built by the farmers. That's not an Army Corps of Engineer levee. That's sort of a you're on your own levee, it sounds like.
Pretty much, yeah. It connects to some Corps of Engineer levees, but it was built by farmers, so the Corps doesn't take any responsibility in repairing that. They have helped in the past, but really they're not getting any help right now. It's basically left up to the farmers to repair it.
To do it on their own. Now, so in recent years, I mean, your area has seen some flooding throughout the county there. What sort of effect have you seen there, both on the schools and on the community in general?
Well, the major effect that we've seen that affects the school is declining enrollment. Flood back in 2011, they came in and offered buyouts to several of the families that lived in the more flood-prone zones, and
to move those families out of the flood areas.
Right. Direct effect on the school has been just in 2011. We had to close down for 2 or 3 weeks because we couldn't get kids to school. The majority of our kids were blocked from the school by water.
Yeah, I just weren't able to get there. No, yeah, we heard Laura Lightbody a few minutes ago describe, she's with the Pew Charitable Trust, sort of the importance of planning ahead and things like that. I mean, can you describe what sort of plans are in place for that type of flooding?
Well, right now, they're just working to try to repair the levee. Back in 1973, the school was flooded due to high water in the rivers. The rivers were high, and then we had a flash flood on top of it where the water couldn't get off, and it did flood the school. back at that time, after we got the school back running, they built a levee around the school. So we don't really worry too much about water getting to the school. Now it's just getting to our families.
And you described a lot of those families are leaving the area because of the threat of flooding and things like that. And yet, you know, the school still there and is sort of a centerpiece, you know, in the community in a lot of different ways. Laura Lightbody, just to come back to you for a minute with the Pew Charitable Trust there, and again, this report that we're talking about, taking a look at flooding, particularly around schools and school districts and the communities there. How did the mapping work? What sort of data went into this map to, you know, that identified Alexander County there as particularly prone to flooding?
To understand how vulnerable counties are to flooding, we looked at three sort of indicators. One is the location of schools within a flood zone. Two is the community that the school serves and its location within a flood zone. And three is that county's experience with federal disaster declarations. So big floods that overwhelm the capacity of the local and state emergency centers. So when you look at Alexander County, for example, our research shows that about 83% of the schools are located in flood zones.
Okay. And Principal Gowan, coming back to you down in Tams, Illinois, I mean, what kind of action would you like to see taken to address that issue of the risk, you know, in your community for the families and for the schools?
Well, if we could just get our levee repaired, that would be a major asset. It's all basically up to the Corps of Engineers and people like that to work on ways to control the water. We have a lot of water that backs up out of the rivers when they do flood, and it affects a lot of our families and our transportation routes.
And you said you're just getting that levee fixed. What would it take to get that levee fixed? And do you think, are people hearing that message? I mean, do you think the officials and people who need to hear that message to fix that levee are hearing that message?
I believe they're hearing it. I don't know if they base a lot of concern on it. You know, where the breach is right now could devastate a lot of the river traffic. It could cut off several thousand acres of farmland and make a straight shot in the river, which would affect the barge traffic as well. So it's not only affecting schools, but could affect the area economically.
Yeah, and that's happened before. I mean, the Mississippi has flooded to the extent where it has done exactly what you're describing there. Brett Gowan, principal down the Egyptian School District in Tams, Illinois. That's in Alexander County, far southern Illinois. Principal, thank you very much, and good luck. We'll pay attention to what goes on with that levee.
Thank you.
Laura, coming back to you here just for a minute, we've heard now two examples from Illinois, but your data does go all across the country. You know, any other things that pop out to you, and what do you hope that people do now with this information?
Yeah, we looked at Illinois. We looked at all 50 states. And when you do look around the country, I think one of the biggest takeaways is that wherever it rains, wherever there's water, it can flood. Our research shows that all 50 states' schools are susceptible to flooding. The regions that tend to rise to the top are the Atlantic Coast, the Gulf Coast, the Mississippi River Corridor, and southwestern Arizona. And this is really, this research really points to the fact that we need to think about preparedness and factor in flood risk when we're planning. So if we do have schools that are located in flood risk areas that have been repeatedly flooded, like the one in Alexander County, maybe it's time to think about relocating that school or taking on mitigation measures that can reduce the risk of flooding in the future.
All right. And it's some of the other things that I know you've described and in the report, you know, taking care of modernizing the maps to some degree so we have the most up-to-date data, and some of those FEMA maps need to be updated. You know, the federal government and the assistance that come in there from FEMA, you know, those pre-disaster plans that you talked about before, and what you just described there in terms of rebuilding smarter, you know, also listed here in the report, just to make sure that schools are in the places that are the safest at the least risk for doing some of these things. But that's Laura Lightbody, directs the Pew Charitable Trust project aimed at reducing the impact of weather-related catastrophes on the U.S. economy, on communities, on the environment. We will link, as I said, to this latest report on flooding as it relates particularly to schools on our website. Also, we'll tweet that out if you follow us at 21st Show. Laura Lightbody, thank you very much. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Scott.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron. Last month, a Wisconsin man was indicted for allegedly trying to steal secrets from a cast iron manufacturer in the Chicago area. The indictment said he planned to use them at his new job in China, but he never made it. According to the Chicago Tribune, he was arrested at O'Hare Airport right before he got on the plane. Protecting secrets from corporate espionage is a growing challenge for many U.S. companies, whether tech firms, manufacturers, even agriculture. Brian Thompson has covered the ag side of this. He's a reporter for KCUR, the public radio station in Kansas City, Missouri. He joins us now on the line from Salina in Kansas. Brian, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much.
You know, this is serious business. There's a lot of money at stake here, livelihoods and things, but there's also sort of a caper element to all of this. You know, we mentioned this story just outside Chicago, a man arrested, federal agents at the airport. You reported a story for KCUR there in Kansas. It unfolded in kind of a similar way. A group of scientists were stopped by U.S. Customs agents at an airport in Hawaii on the way to China. What did they have, and how did they get their hands on it in that case?
Well, they had seeds of rice, and this is rice that had been bioengineered. It's not for food. The Ventria Bioscience is a company based in Junction City, Kansas, and what they make is rice that expresses human proteins for medical purposes. So they take this rice and they extract the proteins and then market those proteins for medical uses.
So how did they get their hands on it?
That is not clear from the case and the indictments and everything else. It's not clear exactly how they did it. However, this Chinese scientist that was working for Ventria, named Weiqing Zhang, was living in nearby Manhattan, Kansas, and when they searched his residence, they found some of these seeds in various places there.
I see. And then there was
how he got them out of the facility, I don't know.
There was a case also then in Iowa where somebody was actually caught digging seed up themselves.
Yes. The defendant there is another Chinese national named Mo Hailong. And he and another Chinese national were out at the site of a Pioneer Hybrid test field. And the manager of the field saw them and confronted him, and Mo Hailong was on his knees digging up seed that had been planted. They gave an excuse, and he received a call on his cell phone, and while he was taking that call, they sped away in their car. Kind of a cloak and dagger type situation.
Well, it is. I mean, and obviously there's a lot at stake here for these companies. I don't at all want to make light of it, but it's kind of fascinating, the inner workings of this. And do you know, well, in the Iowa case, what kind of a seed was that? Do you know?
It was corn.
So that was a corn seed. Okay, so it's sort of a different aspect of that. And do you know what, once these folks, wherever they're from, wherever they're taking them to, once they get their hands on the seeds, what do they do with them?
Theoretically, at least, they take them back to China and reverse engineer them, figure out the genetics, how to do it, and then they'll be able to reproduce the seed on their own. That would be the intention. In the rice case, the seed never made it back to China. They got stopped in Hawaii at the airport as they were preparing to leave the country.
And which seems to be the similar thread to this. I mean, if they're caught and spotted, it seems to be that catching them as they get into the airport. In one case, I understand that they had little popcorn cases full of seeds as one group was trying to leave the country. But the FBI does say that there's an increased threat of espionage, agricultural espionage specifically. I mean, how has Ventria responded to the theft there? And you couldn't even see their field.
Yeah. The only thing that they sell is the protein extracted from that rice. The facility where it's processed is controlled with magnetic key cards, and they are very tight about who gets in and to do what. I wanted to go to a field where the rice is grown and perhaps talk to the farmer that contracts to grow it, and they wouldn't even think of it. And I even offered to be blindfolded, you know, and driven out to the field, and they still wouldn't do it.
Not even blindfolded, huh?
No.
Let's bring someone else into this conversation. Todd Henderson, professor at the University of Chicago Law School, joins us now on the line. Professor Henderson, welcome to the 21st.
Great to be here, Scott.
So, you know, we've been talking, there are a number of examples there. The one up in the Woodstock area in northern Illinois involving technology around ironware and things, now ag and scientific research and corn seeds and different things. But can you kind of paint a more of a broader picture here? I mean, what are the ways that companies can steal trade secrets from one another across industries?
Well, I'm sure this has been going on since time immemorial, and the ways that people can steal from other people defy categorization or the human imagination. Easy, simple ways are to hire people who have worked at, you know, companies in the past and hire them away, and those people bring with them, you know, maybe they're not bringing seeds, but they may just bring know-how. So that goes on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
The advent of technology has made sneaking into people's data much easier. You don't have to break into the warehouse and rifle through the papers. You can just go in because now we have all, it's sort of just the downside of our digital world. So the means are easier now, and the stakes are obviously higher because corporations are much wealthier, and with globalization, there's a lot more returns from this kind of stealing. So my guess is that what we're seeing today is a lot like we saw in the past. The boogeyman might have been different in the past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Japanese companies stealing from Americans or the like.
In the 80s. And,
yeah. But I think this is the kind of thing that, you know, routinely goes on, and the law is very clumsy in its ability to try to catch these folks, in part because a little bit of information leaking out of companies is a good thing. And so finding exactly where that line is about how much information we want to get out of companies versus allowing companies to protect their information is a very delicate balance.
Well, and Brian Thompson, I'm curious. I mean, Todd mentioned technology there. I mean, certainly in agriculture, we see that playing out. A lot of advancements in terms of technology, a lot more secrets to protect, and maybe even a lot more valuable.
Well, yeah, it's Ventry of Bioscience invested $85 million in developing this genetic engineered rice. And the president of the company said that he thought it had the potential to generate upwards of $1 billion in annual revenue. And that, of course, would
That's
be undercut if someone stole the technology. Yeah.
Well, Todd, you know, information obviously has always been valuable, but this kind of proprietary information, seed, data, cast iron skillets, whatever, you know, that value is rising in that way. You know, how is all this affecting the way that that economic espionage works?
Well, companies are spending now on the defense enormous sums of money to protect against this kind of espionage, whether it's the hiring process and making sure the people they hire or trying to make sure the people they hire are not going to be engaged in this. And you can see how that could bias the hiring process. I'm going to be more reluctant to hire maybe Chinese Americans because I'm afraid that they're going to be secret agents for Chinese firms or the like. They spend an enormous amount of time monitoring employees for this kind of behavior. People have to go through lots of routines in protecting and carrying information that they wouldn't otherwise have to do. It's an enormous social loss because all the money we're spending on that is money, this biosciences company that your other guest mentioned, that's money they're not spending on research and development or bringing the products to market. So these are what economists or lawyers like to call deadweight costs. They're just costs that are totally wasted. And so that's the thing why the law can step in and try to punish these things with harsh penalties, because the social losses, it's not just this biosciences company that loses out on their market of $1 billion. Everybody loses when people engage in this. The most common example we give when we teach this in law school is, when I spend money on a burglar alarm, that's money I'm not spending on something else. It could be put to better productive use. And so by getting crime reduced, that means I can, you know, leave my door unlocked and not have a burglar alarm, and I can spend that money on something else. It's the same kind of thing that happens in this case.
Yeah, you said earlier, Tom, that a little information leaking out of companies, that was a good thing. What did you mean by that, and how does that kind of play into, you know, the law and sort of the clumsy way that sometimes you described as trying to deal with this?
Yeah, so we don't want, I mean, the idea of monopolies runs right through law, and we don't like monopolies generally. So when the law gives someone a monopoly, if you have a piece of technology like a grain of rice that can be used in medical treatments, we can give you a patent for that. That's a monopoly given from the government. But you have to disclose that. And the idea of the disclosure is it allows other people to build off of that invention or that technology to build new things. And also to bring competition to the market, because competition to the market lowers prices. You know, if I left the University of Chicago Law School and went to the University of Illinois Law School, I would be bringing with me lots of intellectual capital about how we do things at the University of Chicago, which might be valuable to Illinois. And the law wants me to do that. It doesn't, Chicago can't forbid me from going to Illinois, even though I would be taking some of the quote-unquote secrets from the university here to there. If I work at Coca-Cola and I take the secret formula for Coke, I can't do that, and I can be punished. On the other hand, people, you know, Coke sells their Coke to everybody, and if someone can take Coke and reverse engineer it, then that's, you know, bully for them.
So in the case of these seeds, in the case of agriculture, if somebody were to buy those seeds themselves and take them over and reverse engineer them and recreate them, that's okay. The problem here is they're stealing them out of farmlands?
That's right. And companies can restrict their customers to some extent. So I could put into the contract that when you buy the seeds, a limitation on your ability to use them. So, for instance, when you download music or a movie from iTunes, there are restrictions in that contract that says you're not allowed to go and resell that. You're allowed to use it for 24 hours or for your own personal use or whatever, and they've built in to the law, in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and so forth, restrictions that are saying you're not allowed to do that. Now, contrast that with a book. If I buy a book from, Dan Brown, today, I can turn around and resell that tomorrow, and there's no restriction on my ability to do that, even though I didn't write the book. The law has always kind of had this ambiguous view about people taking information from other people, because in some ways it can be put to good use. That's not defending what the people do, in this case, stealing and giving it to these Chinese firms. Although I should note one important thing here, I think, is that I don't know the data, but I'm pretty confident in saying that American firms steal from American firms more than Chinese companies steal from.
I was going to ask about that. Yeah, I mean, is China an outlier in this way, or is this sort of, are they just bigger and in sort of the large country of the moment, so we hear more about it?
Yeah, I mean, when I was a kid growing up, the boogeyman was Japan. There were these movies
and the Soviet Union
and Rockefeller Center and Pebble Beach, and they were going to take over America. I think the interesting thing about China is that they're both a geopolitical ally and a geopolitical foe at the same time. That's something that wasn't true of Japan. You know, Russia was our sort of geopolitical foe at the time in the 80s. So I think that heightens our sensitivity to the theft. And also, I think another thing is that lots of Americans believe, I think, you know, somewhat true, but maybe somewhat untrue, that our last bit of comparative advantage in the world is our intellectual property. We get out gunned when it comes to low-cost labor and the ability to make stuff by the Chinese.
Yeah.
And so this is sort of the crown jewels of our society, is the ability of farmers in Kansas to come up with these grains of rice that could be done in this way, or Monsanto or Apple or whatever it is. So I think there's a sensitivity about our last comparative advantage plus this kind of strange thing that China is both a geopolitical foe and a business foe.
Yeah.
But I think the problem of corporate espionage is much, much bigger than just a Chinese firm that probably gets the news because it sounds sexy that they arrested this guy on his way to China, and it sounds like a John le Carré novel.
International intrigue, and yeah.
And I when I was a management consultant in my prior life, I was keenly aware of the kind of steps that American companies use to get information about other American companies or out of other American companies, doing, you know, simple things like posting job postings on a website that says, you know, we're looking for people who used to work at XYZ company. We'll hire you for a job where we'll pay you, $2,000 for a day, And that day involves sitting down with those people and downloading their brains about everything they know about XYZ company. And that kind of stuff goes on every day, and it's routine. And there's not, as long as that person didn't sign a confidentiality agreement that promises and they'll never say, there's nothing wrong with that.
But it's all the time we have here, but I appreciate the time. It's an interesting conversation, something I'm sure we'll hear more about. Brian Thompson there, the voice reporter, KCUR, stationed in Kansas City, Missouri. Todd Henderson, professor, University of Chicago Law School. Thank you both. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st. Also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, easy to find there. Just tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st, if you have that enabled. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecilio, and Sean Newman. Megan Jones is our intern. Technical direction engineering support comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Scott Cameron. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media.